Hello and welcome to the Green Room Golf Course podcast from the British and International Golf Greenkeepers Association. Thanks for listening to this podcast, which sheds a light upon the golf industry and what it takes to maintain a modern course. I hope you enjoy the show.
I'm Sammy Strutt, Head of Learning and Development for Bigger, and I'd like to welcome you to this Continue to Learn Extra webinar. I'd like to welcome today James Hutchinson and Dr. Marie Athorne. Many of you are familiar with Bigger's own eco guy, James Hutchinson, known as Hutch to most of us. James is the Membership Services Manager responsible for ecology and sustainability and has been with Bigger for 5 years. During this time, he has advised on over 400 golf courses and developed almost 100 eco reports for Bigger members. Having been a greenkeeper at Fairhaven Golf Club in the north of England, an environmental officer at St Andrews, whilst running his own golf wildlife management consultancy, means that James is ideally qualified for his role. Dr. Marie Athorne is the Business Conservation Advisor to the RNA from the RSPB. She has a PhD from the University of Nottingham on the biodiversity benefits of constructed wetland habitats and has previously worked in ecological consultancy. Joining the RSPB in January 2020, she has undertaken the new role of Business Conservation Advisor to the RNA as part of the new partnership between the RSPB and the RNA. Conservation and ecology have always been her passion and have shaped her career path. Marie has played golf her whole life, and this role has provided her with the opportunity to increase awareness and support for biodiversity conservation on the golf courses. So now that that's the introductions, the formal bit over and done with, I'm really interested to know how each of you got into ecology. Marie, perhaps you can kick us off.
Yeah, sure. So I guess I've always enjoyed kind of being outdoors since I was little. And as you said in the introduction, I've played golf my whole life. So actually part of spending time outdoors was actually on the golf course from a young age, having lessons and then, getting to play. I still remember my first 18 holes now. So, that's quite nice. And enjoying the wildlife that I would see from my own golf course in the Peak District. So, that was part of it. And then I guess kind of my passion and the more focused side of ecology came from when I was doing my degree. So I did a biology degree to start with. And kind of focused on ecology subjects in that. So kind of, the more wildlife side of it as opposed to any, like genetics or anything like that. And then I went on to do a PhD, like you said, at the University of Nottingham. And that looked at comparing constructed reed beds and wetlands that treat sewage or some kind of wastewater to natural reed beds. So that was a real like opportunity to kind of get stuck in, and I did all the field work and stuff myself, but also to meet a lot of people that build these constructed wetlands and kind of the benefits they can provide as well as treating the wastewater for biodiversity. And actually the result of the PhD was that these constructed wetlands can host as much nature and biodiversity as a natural reed bed system can, and the things that influence them are actually the same things that influence natural reed beds, so their age and their size and that kind of thing. And after my PhD, I kind of went on into ecological consultancy, so working with developers and doing protected species surveys to help them kind of navigate wildlife legislation in relation to their developments. And I actually specialised in writing reports and helping developers and making sure the developments were designed to not influence big nature reserves, so international designated nature reserves. So we call them SPAs, SACs and Ramsar sites. So I worked with developers there to make sure they were kind of developing in line with legislation, but also to make sure they didn't impact those sites in the long run. So I feel like kind of my career, my focus in ecology has kind of always been about helping wildlife coexist with people. So, nature reserves are really important and they're kind of fundamental in any kind of nature conservation. But actually, across the board, you need nature to be able to coexist. with people and with land use. So I like to think that, you know, my career and everything I've done up to now will help me, you know, help golf courses to be like kind of good for nature and helpful in that way. So that's kind of a passion of mine in the background, as well as actually seeing the wildlife and surveying for it and being interested in what influences it, but being able to coexist with people at the same time is something, yeah, that I kind of have built through my career.
It's your thing.
Yeah, I'd like to think so anyway.
And James, how about you? What got you into this field and consequently coming to work with the team at Bigger?
Wow, where do I start with this one, Sammy? Oh, blimey. Well, I've always been interested since day one, as far back as I can remember. I was always interested in bird life, bugs in the garden, all sorts of things. But it wasn't until I became a greenkeeper in 1988 that I started to look at trees and grasses and wildflowers and how they interacted with each other and so on. In terms of a study, I undertook an FDSC in agronomy at Myer School College and a Bachelor of Science honours degree. And I looked at ways of using compost, or the desired end result of compost, which is humus, and how it could be returned back to the golf course. I looked at developing winter teas, using the humus mixed with recycled bunker sand, all sorts of recycled materials. And they were a huge success at my last place of work, Fave. And I think they've got about 15 or 16 winter teas built by just recycled materials. So that really is me. So Marie touched on reed beds. One more thing I will add at this point is I used to be hugely interested in reed beds, and I was a whisker away, that far away, from developing a reed bed at Myer School College, but finances and cash decided it wasn't going to be the point, so I decided to do a really cheap one, which was composting. But no, reed beds have always been a huge interest to me. In fact, we designed a few at Bigger for some of our members, so yeah, that's me in a nutshell.
Yeah. Okay, that's great. So, Marie, you're with the RSPB and now working alongside the RNA. Can you tell me what your role as business conservation advisor for the RNA entails?
Yeah, sure. So, this partnership only started in January. And the kind of general concept behind the partnership is providing support for the golf industry to do with wildlife conservation. And that can be like really small things up to habitat restoration, you know, kind of whatever a golf course is trying to facilitate, and providing that support. And whether that's through me personally, you know, coming to do a visit, walking around, having a chat or picking up the phone or whatever, but also actually interacting with other conservation organisations. So, I'm based at the RSPB, but the RSPB has great connections across the conservation sector, and whether we can link golf courses up with different organisations to help them achieve whatever they're trying to achieve on their golf course. So whether it's a rare bumblebee, a rare bat, or, you know, something like that, that the golf course can actually help facilitate that conservation stuff on a landscape scale. So like for the whole industry to be involved, I mean, I think there's nearly 3,000 golf courses across the UK. I think the hectareage is something like 125,000 hectares of that green space that is golf courses. So yes, okay, a lot of that is, it's the playing surface, it's the tees, it's the greens, it's the fairways that perhaps can't be altered too much to help wildlife conservation. But actually golf courses, as most of probably the people listening know, there's huge areas on a golf course that can be managed sensitively for wildlife. And the partnership is about kind of helping them do that, but also maybe highlighting to some people that that's the case, so they don't have to manage it in a certain way for the golf course. Can they think about wildlife in the way that they manage, and can we help do that through, like I say, with other conservation organisations, or even the golf industry is already doing a huge amount for wildlife conservation. I mean, I've only been in this job like 8 months, and the stories that I'm already hearing are fantastic, you know, and actually using these as case studies to help greenkeepers understand what the process was, what was difficult, what was easy. So building these case studies to showcase what the golf industry has already done and help people along their journey to doing the same thing. So things like the Golf Environment Awards already exist as a showcase, but can we use the RSPB platform to encourage that on a bigger scale and help people achieve conservation on their golf course. It's not about turning golf courses into nature reserves or anything like that. It's about the two things coexisting at the same time. Sometimes it needs to be the right conversation with the conservation organisation. So can I help bridge those gaps? So, you know, a greenkeeper might be slightly nervous about reaching out to a conservation organisation because of this, maybe the old stigma that's related to golf. And I would like to think that this partnership is going to help erase that and show that the benefits that golf can have and the green space that they can provide that could be the stepping stones across like an urban landscape for nature. And so can I connect, I know, a golf club in Kent with their local wildlife groups, you know, the local branch of the RSPB even, and do that, you know, I can do that up in Scotland, I can do it. And, you know, the RSPB is such a massive network of people who have this expertise that, through this partnership, we're hoping to share that expertise with golf courses. Then hopefully we help and we spread that expertise, yeah, whether it's from habitat restoration or simple things like, you know, bat and bird boxes and bug hotels and things that they can put in areas that aren't for golf. So the partnership is hopefully gonna actually help facilitate it and for golf clubs to actually do it, but to spread the word about it and make people realize that golf could have this massive positive impact on nature conservation across the UK, and is already helping. You know, I mean, the stories that I've heard in the short time that I've been in the job already are fascinating, and some rare species already using golf courses golf courses don't have to be scared about having rare species on site. It's not something that's going to negatively impact the ability for it to be a golf course and for people to still be able to play it. They can just have this added extra contribution. And to me, that's a massive selling point. That actually you can go to a golf course and you might be able to see whether it's clouds of butterflies on an area that's got wildflowers in it, or whether it's rare birds that are, you know, you might not be able to see, but you know are making a home there. And actually, I'm still able to play my round of golf and then see all those things at the same time. So yeah, the partnership is hopefully using all the connections that the RSPB has and that the RNA have in the golf sector. So, you know, the fact that we're working with you guys and with Bigger and working with organisations like GEO and everybody that works in the golf industry, can we help bring all of that together with nature conservation and hopefully have that kind of like positive impact and change the way that golf is seen, whether that's from a championship course to a municipal course or, you know, whatever your setup is, yeah, whether it's 9 holes, 18 holes, you know, 36, however far you want to go, the whole industry can kind of have a say, and it's hopefully that the partnership can encourage and help that in whatever way, whether it's a small tiny way or somebody speaks to me on the phone or on Twitter, or whether we get RSPB in to help restore a heathland on a golf course or something. You know, that this the range is hopefully going to be quite large. So that's the idea behind the partnership, really.
Can I just build on something you mentioned there, Marie? You mentioned not all golf parts of the golf courses are long roofs and trees and what have you. Most of it, the majority of it, is managed by OSDs and so on. However, in the last 6 or 7 months, I've seen a massive rise in rewilding on golf courses. This is numerous reasons. The furlough schemes to do with one of them. Reduction in staff members, that's another one. But the point is, these rough areas are now joining up areas on the golf courses that weren't joined up before. So your small six-legged beasties and whatever that can't fly to various other habitats are now being joined up on golf courses. So silver lining to every cloud and all that kind of thing. It is a disaster what's happened with the COVID and so on. But I think the wildlife has benefited from this, Karen, I really do.
Yeah, definitely. And I think the connectivity thing you mentioned, James, is really important. I mean, connectivity on a small scale within your golf course, so can you connect up habitats? You know, yeah, whether it is the long rough and the long grasses or whether there's coppiced woodlands that you can join up with a few extra trees or something. But actually, on a landscape scale as well, like those habitats, can you look at where your golf course is in relation to other golf courses or into other habitats that they have on the course? So one thing that, yeah, I've already looked into is heathland, especially. Heathland's a really important habitat for a lot of species that are struggling and in decline. And actually, golf courses quite often provide these beautiful heathland landscapes. And actually, they might not need an alteration in management. You know, they might already be managed in the right way. But actually, you know, for some, it might be just a small change has a huge benefit and actually provides this landscape scale connectivity, like you say, for the small things that can't necessarily fly all over the place. And the RSPB does look into those as well. So the RSPB doesn't just do birds, they do all sorts of other nature kind of related stuff, whether it's small beasties or mammals or the research and the knowledge within the RSPB, it covers more than birds. So hopefully we'll be able to lend those expertise.
That's fantastic what you mentioned then about the RSPB helping with heathland management plans and so on. I have also seen a huge decline in the let's say, I don't know, 30 years or so that I've been in the industry of heathland golf courses. We used to have lots of heathland golf courses, true heathland golf courses. They're just heather, fine mat grasses, more mat grasses, all these kind of things. But of course, the ongoing planting of trees, which is a wonderful thing, in the wrong location on heathland, moorland, chalk downland courses and all this kind of thing has led to the reduction, a massive reduction in true heathland golf courses. So if you can give us any kind of information or guidance, then we're all ears here at Bigger and throughout the golf industry.
Yeah, and I think you hit the nail on the head really there, saying about the tree planting. So, you know, and the partnership also hopes to educate not just, you know, greenkeepers, but maybe hopefully reach out to members and, you know, committees and all those kind of people who might see the taking down of trees on a heathland course as a really negative thing, when actually done in the right way and at the right time and all those kind of things with the right principles behind it, sometimes trees do need removing, and sometimes they need planting in certain places and getting that balance right for the habitats that are on your golf course. And the one thing for me as well is that I'm quite happy to help speak to members or to the committee or to whoever you want. You know, if greenkeepers are worried or have struggled about those things, you know, the educational part of it to me is a really key part. So, you know, if you do some kind of change of management on the golf course and you think there might be some kind of backlash, is that because people don't know why you're doing it? So is it a matter of explaining why you're doing it? Is it a matter of somebody coming in who is perhaps perceived to have the knowledge of those things, the habitat restoration? So, you know, can the RSPB help in that way? Can the brand name help boost, you know, greenkeepers do know what they're doing and they probably have got the right expertise, but sometimes that isn't always appreciated. And so actually, can we come in and say, actually, no, they are doing the right thing and this is an amazing opportunity for your golf club to help? And then suddenly the members are on board and maybe it's an easier journey. So I'm not saying it's as simple as that every time, but maybe if I can help in those ways as well, that's, yeah, part of what the partnership is about. So
super. And this is something else I see a rise of in the last 20 years or so. Greenkeepers, yeah, of course they know what they're doing. Great at heathland management, woodland management, all the above. They've learned everything they need to know about it. But the problem is you often get a council or a committee or a director of greens or something like this that says, well, let's talk to a professional about it. Mm-hmm. Professional comes in, X amount of cash, tells them exactly what the greenkeepers told them. Okay, well, we best listen to James Hutchinson from Bigger. He's come, he's got a letters after his surname, do what he says. And I'm just saying what the greenkeepers have done and have always done for the last part of their life. So to have the RSPB on board as well saying the same thing is going to be fantastic, it really is.
I think during lockdown, a lot of the golf courses became havens for the general public, really, didn't they? Because they became green spaces where they would go out and they would walk and they would suddenly see green, these golf courses in a completely different light, not somewhere where people rolled up and grabbed a set of golf clubs out of the back of their car and that was it and nobody else was allowed. I think it would be really interesting to understand how, from the golf industry, that we can spread the message further about how ecologically sound golf courses and these green spaces can be than those who are already in the know. How might do you think we might be able to do that?
Yeah, James, I can touch on this. So, I mean, for me, engagement with local communities is a really like good place to start. I mean, as a standard nowadays, things like social media and the internet and all those kind of things do play a part, and sometimes they can play a really big part. But actually, if you can engage with your local community, if every golf course starts doing that across the country, that's a huge network of people that are able to spread the word. You know, somebody who lives next door to the golf course and you've engaged with them and you've told them what projects you might be doing on the golf course that help nature or what is seen on the golf course, you know, whether it's birds or butterflies or anything like that. And then they go and tell their neighbour and then they go and tell their friend and, oh, you know, our golf course is doing this. And the word kind of spreads that way. And I think if you can engage people, you know, it's very difficult this year and probably into the future hosting events at the golf club. And that would be, ordinarily, that would be the kind of thing I would suggest. You know, bio blitzes and kids building bird boxes and bat boxes and things. And those kind of things are going to be really difficult going forward. I mean, we've no idea how long COVID's going to last and how long the implications are going to impact on that kind of stuff. But if you can find other ways to engage your community, and reach out to them, and whether it's a local school, you know, you put a wildflower meadow into an area of long rough and you want to put an education sign there to tell the golfers why things have changed and what benefits going to have, can you have the local primary school draw a picture of bees and write a sign that says, you know, save the bees, or something that might ordinarily seem really daft, but actually it's one email, it's maybe one phone call to the local school to say, would you be willing to participate in this? And then maybe it's, you know, a little bit of a chat. You know, if things, you know, if restrictions loosen, for example, you know, could the kids come to the golf course and see the wildflower meadow and see where their signs are going up? And, or, you know, I mean, can it be even more advanced? Can it be the local college art students or something? Do you know what I mean? All those kind of things, engagement with the community and tell them what you're doing and why, I think spreads the message as well as, yeah, the kind of social media aspects and stuff that gets, you know, that's maybe more like a national audience and going out to the unknown, isn't it? But if you can target your local community, then they can spread the word. And yeah, whatever I said earlier, nearly 3,000 golf courses, imagine that on a scale across the UK. There's a great opportunity there, I think.
Really, Montrose Golf Links and John O'Gorn spring to mind with that one. I know Montrose, great guy called Les working there. He does fantastic work with the local community and local school. They've created a wildflower meadow down by the side of the local primary school and invited the kids to come and help manage it and sow the seeds and collect the seeds. So, yeah, that is a fantastic way. But I think I'll Marie and I probably won't agree on everything, but we do agree on social media. I think it's a wonderful tool. However, the Ecology One Bigger page has probably got about 3,000 followers now, something like this, on Twitter. And I'm quite happy to suggest that 2,899 of them all like ecology and do ecology and are interested in ecology. So it's difficult to get the word out on social media unless you have somebody at the top of the social media retweeting your tweets. I've also found that member evening walk and talks or afternoon walk and talks are a fantastic way to get, let's say, an eco report that Vigor have developed for the golf course out there, help them understand what we're trying to create on the actual golf course. I've also found that guest blogs are very good. I wrote one recently for the Woodland Trust, and it was received quite well. So we do need to get the great work we're doing out there. It's just difficult to know how to get out there to a huge, big audience rather than just a few small members or a couple of thousand followers on Twitter. We do need to get the, if any of you can get us on ITV or Countryfile or anything like that, just let me know. Phone me.
Yeah. I'll try my best. And I think one of the things, again, with the partnership with the RSPB name is to hopefully use that platform. So the RSPB magazine has huge numbers of readers that are interested in nature, but perhaps don't necessarily know that nature, you know, golf courses can be good for nature. So, you know, can we use, we're hoping to use that platform as well to boost the idea with like nature lovers, you know, so people realise that it's there rather as seen, you know, perhaps golf courses perhaps in the past seen as a negative aspect. But yeah, so can we using those platforms as well? So yeah, like you say, people following you on Twitter are interested. But I do think, well, I hope at least that social media perhaps provides the opportunity for maybe new greenkeepers coming into it, or greenkeepers that are starting to change their thinking and saying, okay, well, in the past I would have done this, but now I want to start thinking about wildlife more on my golf course. And so, and how do I learn about that? How do I, what, where do I start? So actually can they use the stuff that's on social media? So yeah, like you say, you're already kind of at your targeted audience, but hopefully it's an easy place for somebody to go and look, to start looking for the information that they want to change things on their golf course or at their facility or whatever. So yeah, I'd like to think that kind of keeps going in the background. But like you say, it's not easy to target new people.
I think you've got possibly got the opportunity locally of local press, haven't you? And there's a lot of local magazines that come through your door, you know, free magazines. And it's perhaps contacting them. I'm sure they're always looking for content and good news stories to spread about things that are happening in their community. So that's perhaps another way to go as well.
Yeah, and I think with conservation projects as well. So, I mean, I talked earlier about working with different conservation organisations. So one of the things I've already done is reached out to quite a few of them and said, you know, has anybody ever worked with a golf course before as a simple starter? And the answer every single time has been yes. Yes, we have already worked with the golf club. Yes, they've already helped us on this particular project, or we've reached out to them in this region and got loads of responses. So those things are already happening in the background. And actually what I would like to do is use other conservation organisations to boost the story as well. So, you know, using their social media platforms or their news outlets or whatever. So it almost comes across the conservation board. So, you know, RSPB, Wildlife Trust, Bumblebee Conservation Trust, Butterfly Conservation Trust. I mean, the list goes on. And the idea being that all these are the conservation organisations back the kind of work that the partnership is doing and the golf industry as a whole is doing. I think those things, hopefully, yeah, the more we can get into like general news stories and stuff, the better. And maybe that encourages more golf courses to get involved as well as, you know, the outside world realizing what benefit they can have. So that, yeah, these are all the ideas of the partnership. So hopefully, and yeah, we can push those forward. So
just while you're talking about the partnership, Marie, we've just got a question asking if we can clarify who the partnership is between and where they can perhaps read more about it, what the offering is.
Yeah, so the partnership is between the RSPB and the RNA, with Bigger providing publicity and support and stuff. So yeah, the main partnership is between the RSPB and the RNA. So as the partnership has only just got started, unfortunately at the moment there isn't a website or anything that we can draw you to, but there's stuff on Twitter. So my Twitter handle is Marie A. Thorne Golf. So if you have a search for that on Twitter, I'm putting out loads of stuff about the partnership and what can be done. But hopefully, yeah, in the coming months there'll be a website up and running, and we'll hopefully be hosting maybe stuff on the Bigger website to do with guidance notes and that kind of stuff. So part of the partnership is also producing information that can be looked at by anybody kind of at any time, so that, you know, you don't necessarily have to get in touch with somebody. So that, yeah, these guidance notes will hopefully be available soon for people to be able to read and to get more information about. But yeah, just get in touch if anybody wants to know any more. But yeah, at the moment we've not got round to hosting our own website, but that hopefully is coming in the near future. So there's a centralized place for people to go to. Yeah, that's kind of all built in the background.
We have had discussions with the RNA from Bigger. We've had discussions with the RNA and the RSPB, and we do have a relationship now involved with this partnership. And it is our intention to be hosting information developed by Marie and James on our website. So that will be available to our members at some time in the future when we all get round to taking a breath and figuring out where we go, how we go forward on all of these projects that we're working on at the moment. So those of us that know James fairly well, we all know that you're a tree hugger.
This is true.
As he raises his eyes to the heavens, especially ancient ones. So can you explain to me, who knows little about ancient trees, why they are such important habitats and why we should be protecting them on golf courses and in general?
Well, first of all, I work closely with the Ancient Tree Inventory government-backed project, and the amount of veteran and ancient, true ancient trees we found on golf courses in the last 2 years or so is considerable. You could look at the surrounding area and think, right, farmland. There's a few on farmland, not too many. There used to be quite a lot. They dug them up and created huge potato fields and so on. Are there any in housing? No, there's none in housing, not many in housing. Any in the surrounding industry and something like that? No. The majority of them are on stately homes, old deer parks and golf courses. But why are they important? Well, here we go. So as a tree ages, we'll use an oak as a reference. So an oak, they can live for 1,000 years in the UK, maybe 1,100 years old. There's one claiming to be 1,100 years old. So they age in three parts. First 300 years, they're juvenile. They're just growing up. They're a naughty teenager and so on, same as us lot. And then the second 300 years, they just calm down a little bit. They start to go outward, shall we say, a little bit more. And then by the time they get to 600-700 years old, the class is a veteran, maybe an ancient. And this is when they start going really small and squat and fat, and things start breaking off, and they create cracks and fissures. And in these cracks and fissures and holes, you get fungus and lichens, liverworts, mosses, all the above. Now, this is all food. This is all part of the food chain. But in these cracks and fissures, when they start to get big and large, you start to get nuthatches, tree creepers, woodpeckers going in, raising a family and so on. You also get larger birds coming in, the owls, members of the owl family, tawnies and barns and so on. But the more important thing is bats. Now, I think Marie can expand on this a little bit more, but some of the UK's rarest bats have been found in ancient trees. But not only that, an ancient tree is an absolutely beautiful thing to look at. Maybe it's only me saying this, but I don't know. I actually gave a talk to a local wildlife trust a couple of years back, and I was talking about trees and ancient trees, all the ones we found on golf courses. And there was a little old lady in the front row, and she said, "Do you know what you are?" Wagging her finger. I thought, here we go, golf courses, waste of land, fertilizer, pesticide, all the above. She said, "You, James Hutchinson, are a dendrophile." And that was it. And I said, "Oh, thank you very much." And I thought, blimey, I've been... really insulted, but it's a lover of trees, so there we go. Yes, I'll take that. I'm a dendrophile. So they are hugely, hugely important organisms, certainly to have on a golf course. But back to bats, and I think Marie is probably best placed to talk this one a little bit further.
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, I for those of you who don't know me, I do a lot of bat work in my spare time, in my own time. And I used to do a lot of bat work in my old job. So they're kind of a bit of a hobby of mine, a bit of a passion of mine. And there's so many different species of bat in the UK. So there's 18 species of bat that live in the UK. And actually a lot of these do depend on trees to live in. So some will use buildings. So some of the commoner species have adapted to live in buildings now. But a lot of our rarer bats are dependent on trees. And like James says, as trees get older, they get features in them that they kind of open up and they crack, or woodpeckers make a hole in them. And they're all the kind of places that bats love to roost. So actually any tree that kind of has any feature, whether it's a small rot hole, yeah, whether it's a bit of lifted bark, they can support bats. And actually most golf courses probably provide really good foraging habitat for bats. So if you've got a bit of long grass that supports invertebrates, if you've got trees, and especially the older trees that support a lot of invertebrates, that's what the bats are going to eat. So you know, bats will eat anything from, you know, mosquitoes to moths to crane flies, and you know, these are all in a bat's diet. And so all of those things do occur on golf courses. So actually, if you've got your food and your home in the same place, for an animal, that's pretty good. So yeah, ancient trees and golf courses are a huge potential to support bats. And I guess there is a bit of a precautions to be taken in this case. So all bats are protected in UK law. So their home, so wherever they roost, whether that is a building or a tree, is protected by law from damage or being destroyed, and in some cases being disturbed. So there does have to be a little bit of caution exercised about what kind of management you would do to a tree that could potentially support bats. And this doesn't have to be like a terrifying, daunting thing that, you know, you're going to go to jail or whatever. It's really not that terrifying. And sometimes it's a case of picking up the phone to somebody and saying, okay, well, this tree, we've been told this tree is now dangerous and it might fall over. And actually, it's not too far from where golfers might walk. So then you make the decision as a golf club to, you maybe need to take that tree out. So I would, for one, maybe suggest really thinking that through. Just is it really a danger? So I know a lot of the kind of guidance around when trees will fall over and that kind of thing now is all changing. So the advice that an arboriculturist will give around whether a tree is about to fall over. So as James says, you know, an oak tree is starting to die, but it's probably got another 300 years to go. You know, it's not going to necessarily fall over straight away. So make sure you really consider those things, because they're such valuable habitats. And I also think from a landscape perspective, when you're playing a golf course, actually such a big, like James says, beautiful tree is a feature on your golf course could really be missed if it's taken out. So really consider whether it's necessary for it to come out in the first place. But if it is, there is wildlife legislation and laws around protecting certain species. And it is sometimes just a case of having a survey done and somebody checking whether there's any bats there before you take the trees down. So it's a real balance of just making sure you're covered in terms of wildlife legislation, but it doesn't have to cost loads of money. It doesn't have to incur serious delay. And this is kind of one of my areas of expertise from my previous job. So I'm more than happy to take phone calls off people if people are concerned about these things. And I can put you in touch with local bat groups who might even be able to help, in some cases potentially free of charge, if not for a very small fee, to make sure that those trees aren't bat roost and they can come down okay. And even if they are, like these things have licensable activity, so you can still take the tree down. You might just have to put up a bat box somewhere else on the golf course. So it's not something to be afraid of. In fact, I think it's something that's potentially quite exciting. You know, if you've got bats on your golf course, and like James says, walking around with members, again, a real nice opportunity to get engaged with people, a bat walk around the course. And okay, at the moment that might be slightly more difficult given COVID, but maybe by next spring, when bats start coming back out of hibernation again, we'll be in a position to have bat walks around a golf course, where you can have your local bat group, you know, come with a detector, walk around. The greenkeepers could maybe be there and talking about the different projects on the golf course and the different management and the wildlife that it supports. And it's just such a great engagement opportunity. And bats are really something that people don't get to see very often. I mean, regularly, you know, if I'm out doing a bat survey, somebody will walk by and say, oh, there's no bats here. I say, well, look above your head. There's one flying over you right now. And people actually are amazed to see them. It's just a really nice engagement tool for people to.
So, Marie, I guess what you're saying in a roundabout way is that I can send bigger members to you when I find a buff on the golf course.
Yes, you can. Yes.
Yeah. This is recording? Yes, yeah, we can. Dr. Marie said yes.
So we've been asked a question by one of the viewers about reconciling the benefits of veteran trees with the pressures of health and safety. Obviously, if it's on a golf course and there's golfers nearby, then the golf club is going to be very aware that a limb may go wild and fall off a tree and hit a golfer. So how do you reconcile that if you're doing an eco report and they've got a particular concern about veteran trees?
If you've got a particular concern and there is a health and safety issue, then the tree does have to be managed. You can just give it a basic haircut. Just look at the limb that's leaning over, let's say a tee or a green or something like this. Get the professionals down. Let's have a word with Marie. Let's have a look at it. And if it is deemed as a health and safety issue, if it is going to fall on a greenkeeper underneath or when one of the team's working on it, it's probably got to go, that the individual limb. In terms of an actual decaying oak tree or an ash tree, they are very sturdy. Over time, they tend to lose the center section, so the heartwood of the tree goes. But the cambium, the bark, starts to form a tube. And when that dies, after 500, 600, 700 years, that tube is now a monolith and it doesn't tend to go anywhere. So what I do suggest is, if it's a health and safety issue, or is the limb overhanging a green or a tee, then yes, it's got to go after we've looked at every opportunity. But you should leave the main trunk of the tree standing. Leave it for saprophytic organisms, these wood-dwelling creatures that rely on decaying timber. So it's got to go, but have a word with the professionals.
Yeah, and I think I'd just like to back up what James has said there. Like, you do need professional advice, and if somebody does say, you know, this is dangerous and it's potentially going to, you know, injure somebody or hurt somebody, then, you know, yes, they do have to go. But the other thing that can be considered is, if you do take the limb off, can you leave the dead wood on site? You know, do you have somewhere where that can be put? So do you have a small coppice of woodland? Can it be left at the base of the tree? Maybe if the other side of the tree is out of play or whatever, can you leave it there? And then all those organisms that are kind of within that branch or related to that tree can still carry on living. I mean, deadwood is such a kind of a resource that's so rare now, for the idea that, you know, places need to be tidy. This is the kind of general concept of things that need to look tidy and nice. And actually, all the species that are associated with deadwood are really struggling and in decline. So actually, maybe yes, the limb does need to come off or part of the tree needs to come down. But can you still do it in a way that's sensitive to wildlife as well as protecting the health and safety? So, you know, we're not saying put people's health and safety at risk at all. But can things be considered all the way through the process and kind of, yeah, still help wildlife while protecting them?
And Marie, you suggested stacking the timber, and it's massively important that we do stack decaying timber vertically as well as horizontally. I always see it horizontal. It's important that you stack some vertically as well for the stag beetle, or the female stag beetle have been massive decline in the last 50 or 60 years through habitat loss, the usual story. But she only lays her eggs in decaying upright timber. So very, very picky she is. She won't lay it in horizontal, it needs to be upright. So if you're going to stack your timber, make sure some is upright or slightly. So yeah.
Okay. So if I was a greenkeeper who has developed a particular interest in ecology and is looking for a way to get involved, how would they start? What's a good starting point? Phone James.
Come to me. Phone me up. Yeah, I give you tons of passion and interest, and you into the role. It is becoming huge in the greenkeeping industry that we do look after the critters that live on the golf course. Mm. Ecology is really important, and greenkeeping is just ecology. That's all it is: growing grass in soil. two organisms living together, interacting together, interacting with the fungus and the mycorrhizae and how it all grows, talking to the trees. They all talk together, trust me. And so, greenkeeping is ecology anyway, but a good place to start if you don't come to me, secondly is Marie. Or the third place is your local wildlife trust. I live in Blackpool, so it would be the Lancashire Wildlife Trust. Cheshire Wildlife Trust is a little bit further on. Just try and get involved that way. They might even come out to your golf course and give you half an hour talk on the best way to manage your golf course. So you're actually getting free advice through the fact that you want to be more wildlife friendly. Well, the key is to show your passion and enthusiasm, and don't be afraid to get your hands dirty. That's one thing I will say. I mentioned I wrote my dissertation on compost, or the four stages of composting, and the final stage or the final stage is to get your hands in the compost, give it a rub. Is it claggy? Is it dry? Is it too dry? Is it too moist? Or give it a smell. What's it smell like? If it smells pungent and a really bit whiffy, then it's not quite ready. It's probably at the first or second stage, maybe the thermophilic stage. It's when it smells like mushrooms or freshly mown grass or something. When it smells slightly musty but fresh, that's not an oxymoron, trust me. It's something you need to learn. But get your hands dirty. Don't mind getting stuck in. I think that's the best way to get involved anyway. So if you're a greenkeeper.
Yeah, and I think, you know, reaching out to, whether it's James, whether it's me, whether it's other conservation organisations is definitely a start. But I think as well, don't be afraid to just try something, bat and bird boxes. A lot of golf clubs I've spoken to do already have them, but that is just such a simple, easy way to start. And one of the things that hopefully that will be coming out in guidance notes soon about bird boxes is, can you have a think about the species that are on your course? So, you could put up a standard bird box that would attract a blue tit or a grey tit, but those species generally are doing okay. It doesn't mean they don't need help in some areas, but generally they're doing okay. But instead, could you slightly alter the design of the bird box and put something up, say, for a spotted flycatcher, a species that's declined massively over the last few decades? And actually, if maybe you've got somebody on one of your members who's seen one flying around the course, and actually they might need a little bit of help. And so could you put up a nest box for them? Could you put up a nest box for barn owls or tawny owls or something like that? So can you have a think about the species that you might have seen? And actually, your members, as well as your greenkeeping staff, who quite frankly are probably out at the right time to see a wildlife on the course, but your members are a great source of information of what species occur on the course already. And can you actually use that to see what species you target? So just really, really simple things to start you off. Can you perhaps mow less around the edge of a water body and leave a nice fringe of habitat from a water body? Really, really simple things that can just get you started. When you can be reaching out for advice and starting to talk to people. So that hopefully the guidance notes that I'm bringing out will help people get started. But so many people are, like James says, full of enthusiasm to speak to you about these kind of things. So don't be afraid to reach out whether it's to Bigger, whether it's to other conservation organisations, because most people are willing to help. And especially if you're enthusiastic, of the stories I've heard from within the RSPB of people speaking to greenkeepers, they're a lot of the time they're a little bit surprised how passionate people are. And so if you can put that across.
Just a bunch of kids.
Yeah.
Just a bunch of big kids, really, let's be honest.
I guess a nice way to get the golf course and the golf club and the members engaged could be to do sort of a species list, and to get the members to say, oh well, I've seen this, and get them involved in the identification.
I'm not afraid to say this, Sammy, but I'm a bit of a tea leaf. I've stolen some ideas from some of the big wigs in the industry, namely Bob Taylor. He gave me some advice. He says, to get members of a golf course interested, the best thing you can do is place a wildlife sightings book in the clubhouse, in the foyer. Just leave it there. Don't do anything. Come back in a couple of weeks and see who's involved. You may have a retired BTO or RSPB worker in there who can identify birds just by the call or by the nest or by the flight pattern that they use. And next thing you know, in a month's time, you've got sightings on a golf course from reputable people of things that you never knew you had, spotted flycatchers, lesser spotted woodpeckers, these types of things are absolutely amazing creatures. And the chances of a bog standard, somebody like me, a greenkeeper, finding one of these things is damn near impossible unless you have somebody on site quite a lot, i.e. a golfer, who knows what he's talking about and can identify these birds. So I'm not ashamed to say that I stole that idea.
Yeah, and I think I mean the member engagement side of things as well is quite important. I mean, we've already talked about it quite a bit, but yeah, if you can get them to contribute sightings, and it almost like it quite often becomes competitive, you know, who's seen this and who's seen, and which, you know, whether it's butterflies or it's birds or yeah, whatever else they might have seen. I'm sure, yeah, you engage your members in that and there'll be some great stories coming out. And I think as well, I mean, my own golf course has a guy who, is part of BTO ringing community, and he does all that kind of stuff. And he produces a monthly newsletter for the golf club to showcase what he's seen. And it isn't just birds, it's all sorts of other things as well. And so then that goes out to the members. So actually, suddenly you've got a member speaking to the rest of the members about what's there and using that resource to get you started on small projects on the golf course. It's just a great place to start for people to see that you're doing stuff for animals that are already using the golf course. Is a big thing. I mean, you might want to try and attract something new that you know is on adjacent land. But maybe a bit more specialist advice is needed. But to help stuff that's already there, yeah, can you use your members to kind of gauge what's there and then build on that? I think is a really, really nice idea. Yeah, Bob knows what he's talking about, doesn't he?
Lots of great content for blogs and newsletters, doesn't it, to the members, and even vlogs if you've got somebody who's particularly handy with their video skills. It can make for a very nice and engaging member benefit, really.
And I think if you've got people who are interested in photography as well, again, a lot of people at my own golf course, and I've heard across other golf clubs as well, is, you know, you have somebody who's interested in photography and they go out and take some pictures on a recognisable part of your own course, and you say, oh, you know, there's a deer walking across that bit of the course, or here's a butterfly on some flowers on the edge of the 12th green or something, do you know what I mean? And those kind of things, they're all opportunities for greenkeepers and members to engage. And I know sometimes those relationships can be really difficult, but if you can, maybe wildlife is an opportunity to talk about something positive, and then if the greenkeepers and the staff can build on that and say, oh, well, okay, so you told me you'd seen this. Well, actually, now we've created habitat for this to hopefully enable this species to stay. I think, yeah, the two kind of go hand in hand, and it's a really nice opportunity to build on that with your members' support, because, yeah, sometimes I know it can be difficult. But a really nice opportunity there. So,
just jumping back to trees, we've just got a comment from the audience reminding us all that tree preservation orders are likely on golf courses, especially where the site is surrounded by buildings. And it's a cautionary tale, really, to ensure that all of the necessary paperwork that you require is in place before you do any tree work, as carrying out unauthorised work can attract a fine of up to £20,000 per tree. So I don't think many golf clubs would be wanting that hitting their desks at the moment. So just a cautionary tale to those that might be listening. So
contact your local tree council officer.
Local tree council officer, right. Fantastic.
Yeah, and I think any consultant that might be brought in at that stage would look into those kind of things. So this is kind of perhaps where the importance of professional advice would come in, and they should pick up that kind of thing to make sure things aren't missed. And yeah, like you say, TPOs can incur quite big fines. It doesn't mean you can't do the work. Mm-hmm. I had a little bit of experience in my old job with TPOs. It just means you now need to get the right paperwork in place. So yeah, they were right to bring that up, and professionals should be able to help with that and get the paperwork necessary for things to go ahead, especially if it's related to health and safety. Yeah. It's just a matter of having the right paperwork in place.
Okay. So with that cautionary note, I have got one final question for each of you, which is, What is the your favourite thing that you have spotted on a golf course?
Shall I go first? Shall
I? Oh, blimey, yeah. Where would you start with that one?
I mean, mine isn't anything particularly rare, but it's a memory from my childhood of playing at my own course. And there's a particular hole where I would always see a green woodpecker fly across the course. And during a competition that I was playing with my dad once, I actually stopped to the back of my backswing because I saw it fly across in front of me. And it's just kind of a tale I always tell about how interested I am in nature, and I still don't really know how I stopped my backswing. Yeah, it's just, I think it's a nice story about, yeah, seeing wildlife on your golf course that, yeah, even if they are fairly common, just that experience while you're enjoying a round of golf. Mm.
Perfect. Well, for me, it's got to be, and I mentioned earlier, Montrose Golf Links. Walking around there with the mentioned Les, the assistant greenkeeper, the deputy greenkeeper there, and a short-eared owl landed on an out-of-bounds post probably no more than 7 to 10 meters away. Now, these things are hugely impressive. Huge big birds like this landed right in front of us, and it stayed there for about 7 or 8 seconds, long enough to get the zoom lens out, you know, zoom right in it, right, see the colour of its eyes and everything. So that, for me, that stands out quite a lot. The second one that stands out quite a lot is the deer at East Parks golf course, Sammy. But we won't go further on that one. It involved a deer writing off my car and the police. So there we are. That was quite memorable.
That one was quite memorable for you then. Yes. Yeah. Having lived on the edge of a golf course as well, I think, you know, seeing badgers and deer as you drive down the drive at night and they just suddenly appear in your lights, that's quite fascinating as well. Well, we've been chatting for an hour, believe it or not, so I'm going to bring us to a close now and thank you both for a very enjoyable and interesting discussion. I'd like to let everybody know that Marie will be presenting at Biggers National Regional Conference taking place on Tuesday the 10th of November, where she'll be providing further information on simple steps that you can take to encourage wildlife onto the golf course. We'll also be working with Marie on articles for Greenkeeper International and, as we alluded to previously, for resources on the on our website that you'd be able to use and help at your golf course. I really hope that you've enjoyed today's webinar. For further details of our programme of events, please visit the What's On page of the Bigger website, and for our webinars, you can pre-register. So I'd like to thank you all again for joining us, Marie, James, and I look forward to welcoming you all back again very soon. Thank you very much. Enjoy
your evening. Thanks,
Sammy. Thanks.
The Green Room Golf Course podcast is produced by myself, Carl Hansel, on behalf of the British and International Golf Greenkeepers Association. For questions, comments and concerns, you can get in touch with me by emailing carl@bigger.co.uk. That's Carl with a K. You can also join the conversation on social media using @greenroombigger. And we've also got a Facebook page where all the latest notices, news releases and information from Bigger can be found. We're also on Instagram using @bigger_HQ. Subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. The more people know about the sports turf industry, the more understanding they will have about the hard work of Bigger members and other greenkeepers. And speaking of Bigger membership, if you're inspired by what you hear to progress your career in greenkeeping, then a major first step is signing up to the association. The opportunities for career development are countless and potentially life-changing, such as volunteer opportunities at major tournaments and educational opportunities across Europe and the USA. Don't forget, if you're a golfer and you've got any questions about anything you hear on the podcast, have a conversation with the greenkeepers at your club. They've got the expertise to explain what's happening at the course and how it fits into the team's long-term vision to improve playability and enjoyment of the facility.